Okay, welcome to the July edition of Ask an Astronomer. And you may, if you're listening carefully, detect the lack of an Antipodean twang to my accent. And that's because I am, in fact, not Nick Rattenbury introducing things as normal. Nick's disappeared. He's escaped from Jodrell to parts unknown. And I'm going to have to look after it. Tim O'Brien here, as usual. And this time, I'm going to actually make a change by asking a question of my erstwhile colleague, Ian Morrison, who's standing in for Nick.
Yes, hi, good afternoon.
Okay, Ian. Right, question for you. The Star of Bethlehem. It's a well-known thing. It's a very seasonal topic, of course, this being the middle of summer. But
Absolutely, yes.
anyway, we're going to ask it anyway. Star of Bethlehem, this sort of thing that the three wise men were supposed to have followed to lead them on their way to the stable where Jesus was born. The question we've been asked is there any astronomical object or event that might actually explain the sort of appearance of the Star of Bethlehem?
Well, it's a very good question and not a particularly easy one to answer. Yes, look, everybody believes it must have been some astronomical event. The question is, what could it have been? So the first question we actually have to ask ourselves is when was Jesus born? And it's not obviously 0 BC, as far as we know. In fact, for quite a while, it was thought, maybe some people still think, it would have been about 5, maybe even 6 BC. But we now believe a monk made a transcription error in the Middle Ages because things were passed on just by copying things out. And it could well have been that Jesus was born in 1 or possibly 2 BC. Now, of course, that determines the time when we need to look to see what was in the sky. Now, as far as we know, there were no novae or supernovae. These are stars that appear very, very brightly in the sky for a short time, and that would be an ideal sort of candidate. There was one, in fact, was it 1977, Tim?
No, there was one of the famous ones that was very bright
Yeah.
was Nova Cygnus
Yes.
in 1975.
Oh,
So
75.
that really changed the appearance of the constellation of Cygnus then. It was
Absolutely, I
so
remember
bright, but
that.
they're rather unusual, and there's certainly I don't think you're saying there's no
There
records
are
of
no
such an
records
event.
whatsoever. Now, another thing could be a very bright comet, but again, there's nothing in any of the historical astronomical records to say there was a bright comet at the time, and certainly Halley's Comet, which is one that comes around about every 85 years, that wasn't in the sky either. Now, there was, however, one particular set of circumstances that I think had great, let's say, astrological significance. Remember that the wise men were interested in the motions of the planets and when they appeared together and where they were in the sky. They're not quite the same as modern day astronomers like Tim and I. Now, there's a constellation, Leo the Lion, which in fact was linked to the house of David, the lineage that Jesus belonged to. That has, as its brightest star, Regulus. And in the Latin, that's Rex, which is king. So that's the king star, you might say. Now, if we come back to our solar system, we have Jupiter, Jove, the king planet in some sense. Now, at around the right time, about 2 BC to 1 BC, there was a very, very rare circumstance. What happened was that Jupiter came very close to Regulus three times over the course of a relatively short period.
Very, very close, apparently in the
Apparently in the
sky,
sky, yes,
rather
because
than.
of course Jupiter is a planet quite nearby, Regulus is a star a very long way away, but they would appear very close. We call that a conjunction, and so this was a triple conjunction. And to be a very close conjunction with a bright star is really quite interesting.
Sure.
And Regulus, it would happen very, very rarely indeed. What happened was that as Jupiter moved across the heavens, basically from west to east, it first passed very close indeed to Regulus. In fact, you'd need to look fairly carefully to see that there were two different objects
Right.
together. It then carried on for a while, but then turned round in the sky and went westwards, not quite so close, and passed just north of Regulus, and finally turned round again, continued its eastward path, passing again. Now, that wiggle in the sky is actually due to the Earth sort of running around on the inside track. It's due to the motion of the Earth. So that very rare event may well have triggered the wise men to make the passage to Bethlehem to see the young king out of the lineage of David.
Well, that's an interesting theory. Now, I think, I mean, funny enough, it reminded me while you were talking there, you talk about Regulus, it reminded me of a slight embarrassment that occurred to us a few years ago when we had a team. Jodrell Bank had a team on University Challenge. If you've seen that program, they have this series called The Professionals, where they get groups of, in our case, we were the astronomers, and we were up against the Royal Society of Literature. And one of the questions actually involved, the answer to which was supposed to be Regulus, which was this bright star in Leo. And I think I remember sitting there when this question was asked and thinking, the only star I know in Leo is Regulus. But the other, it was a multi-part question. The other part of the question was that this answer had to be something to do with the smelting process. And I was thinking, Regulus? No, never heard of anything to do with Regulus.
So I didn't
answer. And of course, turns out the answer was Regulus. And if you do a Google search for smelting and you have a look at that, there is a product in smelting that's called Regulus. So I'm afraid that's what that brings to mind for me. But never mind.
Oh, well. We still won. We did beat them in the end by five points.
That's true. So. Okay.
I think I've got a question for you. Yes. Someone has written in and said, why is it we sometimes see only part of the moon?
Ah, right. Yeah, that's right. So this is a question that basically is about the phases of the moon, isn't it?
Yes.
So I think the point here is that when you look up at the moon, you see the moon in the sky. That when I discuss these things with people, you sometimes find that people don't even realise that you can see the moon during the day. Sometimes.
No, absolutely.
You know, there's this conception that the moon is only up at night. Yes. Of course, it can be visible at any time of day or night.
And in fact, if you do see it sort of in the early evening, you can actually make out quite a bit of detail.
Yeah.
When it's not quite so bright, you can see the Maria quite well.
Right.
It's worth looking at.
So it's not, so that's one point to make, first of all. The other point is that when you do look at the moon, you'll notice sometimes you see a crescent, sometimes you see a sort of half moon shape, sometimes you see the full moon, and sometimes you can hardly see the moon at all, something called the new moon. And I think one of the important thing, first of all, is to make sure that you don't make the confusion between these so-called phases of the moon and eclipses. Because another sort of common misconception is that the change in shape is because the part of the moon that we see is the part that's illuminated by the sun. And one way of wrongly imagining this is that perhaps it's the Earth's shadow that's cast on the moon.
Yes.
And that's what causes part of the moon to appear dark and the other part to appear light. Now, it's nothing to do with that. It's actually because the moon is a sort of spherical object, roughly spherical object in orbit about the Earth. And if you imagine as the moon moves around the Earth sort of once every 28 days or so, roughly, there are times when the moon might be, say, more or less on the opposite side of the sky to the sun. So if the sun was setting, for example, the moon might be just rising. And in that case, if you imagine the light from the sun sort of heading past the Earth and illuminating the moon, then we'll get to see pretty much the whole of the side of the moon that's facing towards us. So that's the full moon. So that appears quite circular. And because quite often that's when... You know, as I say, if you can imagine the sun setting and the moon low down, this big full moon, you see this sort of giant full moon hanging above the horizon, absolutely gorgeous. And in fact, it does give the impression it's much larger than it is when it's higher in the sky, doesn't it?
The moon is actually not that big in angular size. Later this month, it comes very close to the Pleiades cluster. And in fact, you'll see that the Pleiades cluster is about three times larger, even though that to us looks quite small. So it's not that big. The reason it looks so large near the horizon is perhaps due to it's a sort of psychological optical illusion. When we look up at the sky, we don't see it as a hemisphere above us. It appears very flattened. The horizon seems much further away to us in perception than directly overhead. Mm-hmm. So if we see the moon on the horizon, our brain thinks it must be further away and actually puts a sort of a scale factor in to compensate, and that makes it look bigger.
So that's a full moon, and the opposite extreme would be if the moon was quite close to the sun on the sky. Now, if the moon was exactly in the same direction as the sun, then obviously it would block the light from the sun, and we'd have a total solar eclipse like the one we went to visit, or went to see when we went to Turkey.
It's wonderful. Was it March 29th, I think?
Yeah.
Beautiful eclipse.
Yeah. So... In fact, there isn't, if you think about the moon going round and round the Earth every month, if the moon orbited the Earth in the same plane as the Earth orbits the sun, then in fact you'd get a total solar eclipse every month. Now, they don't happen that often, and that's because the moon's orbit is inclined at an angle to the so-called plane of the ecliptic, which is the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun. So in fact, only every so often will it actually line up with the sun. So it usually misses it. However, you can get a direction where the moon is relatively in the same direction, roughly the same direction. And if you can imagine what happens then, the light from the sun sort of shining on the far side of the moon from how we see it. And so the side that we can see is actually not illuminated and so appears relatively dark. The way in which you can still see some details on the unilluminated bit of the moon is by something called Earthshine, isn't it?
That's right. The clouds, particularly if it's quite cloudy across the Earth, that reflects light back, and you can actually see the Maria and some of the details on the lunar surface. And in fact, there are some very nice photographs during totality actually showing the structure of the surface of the moon purely by Earthshine.
Mm. So it's quite tempting, isn't it, to call... I referred to the far side of the moon then, didn't I?
You did.
It's quite tempting to use this phrase, the dark side of the moon.
Yes, well, that's another misconception, that the back of the moon is always dark, and the answer is it isn't. It will be totally dark when we have full moon,
right,
because that means the moon is beyond the Earth, away from the sun, so the backside is dark. But, of course, at new moon, then we don't see the surface illuminated, but the whole of the back will be.
Right.
So, in fact, it will show phases too, if you could look at it from somewhere far away.
So I've composed my letter to Roger Waters and David Gilmour, and I shall be sending it later. I hope you'll co-sign that letter with
me. Absolutely.
Okay, so we've seen two extremes. We've talked about new moon, we've talked about full moon, and then sort of halfway in between, when the moon is sort of at right angles to the direction to the sun, and if you can imagine that, then one half of the moon, as we view it, would be illuminated by the sun. And that's this sort of, this half moon, or in fact it's...
First quarter it's called, yes.
Yeah, so it's a sort of quarter of the way through the cycle of phases, although so it's a bit confusing in a way, because you'd like to call it half moon, really, but the official title is first and last quarter for these phases. If you're interested in finding out a bit more about that, and particularly I think if you've got children and they're going through the sort of primary school at the moment and learning about these sorts of concepts, which is on the curriculum, then you may want to have a quick look at a website that we've got at Manchester University. It's called the Children's University, and the address is www.childrensuniversity.manchester.ac.uk. And there's actually nice interactives that describe these concepts of the phase of the moon on that website. So it's definitely worth a look, I think.
It is. It's very good.
Okay, I think that's about us finished for another month. Thank you, Ian, for standing in for Nick.
A pleasure.
We'll have to see. There'll have to be a vote on whether Ian's actually done sufficiently well to replace Nick. I think send in letters. Let us know whether you think we should have Ian instead of
goodness.
Nick.
No way.
I think we'll probably have Nick back, and Ian can go back to his night sky this month.
You get enough of me on the night sky page. So.
Right. Thanks very much anyway.